Hello, fellow Kentuckians and other friends, and welcome to a new edition of My Old Kentucky Podcast. My name is Robert Connie, and joining me, as always, is Jasmine Smith. Jasmine, how are you today?
I'm doing well, Robert. How are you?
I'm doing great. I was sick last week, and I feel better. So, here's hoping that I don't get
sick. Glad to hear it.
Yeah. Our guest this week is Attica Scott. No stranger to this show. She was our very first guest, I think. Like, way back in, like...
Yeah, she was.
2017 or something.
2017.
Like that. Very long time ago. So she's been on the show several times through the lots of different things that she's run for, including State House, U.S. Congress, and now she's running for State Senate against Gerald Neal, who's a long-term incumbent. We talked to her about that. We talked about her place in Kentucky history. We talked to her about what issues she wants to champion and the role that she will play in Frankfort. A very good discussion. I mean, I always love to talk to Attica Scott. What did you think, Jasmine?
Yeah, I really enjoy talking to her, and I'm always appreciative of her since she was our very first guest, and I'm appreciative of the policies that she advocates for, and, you know, she does make some interesting points. She's running against someone who's been in office 35 years, and like I mentioned on the show last week, I think he took office before I was born, yep. So... I think that's a really interesting primary.
Yeah, it definitely is. Just so people know, we have reached out to Senator Neal. Haven't heard back from him. If he gets back to us before the primary, we'll do something short with him. We'll put it out there. But we did record this with Representative, or I guess Honorable. If you are no longer in office but have served in office, you are the Honorable. So the Honorable Attica Scott, talking to her about her candidacy. And that election is Tuesday. So definitely listen to her if you live in the district, which is a quite large Senate district. But before...
Yeah, I didn't realize it went to the Bullitt County... line. Yeah. So that is something I learned.
The Senate districts in Louisville are the dumbest looking things. But what are you gonna do? What you're gonna do is you're gonna try to sue and you're gonna lose, which is what happened when they sued about those things. Anyways, we do have other things to talk about this week. I'm gonna do an update on JCPS, which, believe it or not, has more things to talk about this week. So we're gonna update some of the stuff around the start times and kind of what's going on around there. And then Jasmine's gonna preview the congressional races. I think 2 weeks ago you did primaries on the Republican side, and last week you did State House primaries on the Democratic side, and this week we're doing congressional primaries. So lots of good information, some interesting races potentially in some of those races. So without any further ado, let's talk about JCPS. All right, Jasmine, not surprising to you or probably many of the people listening, but there seems to be an unending stream of stories about JCPS this year, most of which stem from issues around transportation and relatedly about start times. Stuff happened again recently when JCPS shifted start times yet again. So whenever we talk about this, I don't know, level setting, giving some context is important. I don't want to do this every time, but, you know, I think it's worth a full reset for this because of kind of where we end up at the end of this story. It could be said that this story really started when JCPS tried to do something about the perennial issue of students not getting to school on time via the bus. This was something that had been happening for like a decade or longer. It was a long-term problem that had gotten worse and worse over time. And finally, they were like, we're going to do something about this. The number of routes had dwindled, the number of bus drivers had dwindled, and really the problem at the time when they tried to fix it was students were missing up to an hour of school in the morning, and schools were having to like rotate what class went first so that kids could make sure that they had that class. I mean, it was kind of crazy the hoops that were having to be jumped through because of the transportation issues that predated what we saw this year. So, JCPS worked with a contractor and evaluated several options and tried to create like a hyper-efficient routing system that was built through AI and all these kind of like, high-tech things to be like, all of these things can work if we do it this way. But the plan ended up being like, you know, trying to squeeze, is it blood from a rock? That's what I put in the notes. I don't know if that's the idiom. You're trying to squeeze blood out of something that doesn't have blood in it. Yeah, it didn't work.
I don't know that one.
It didn't work at all. The plan totally flopped. It was a total failure. On the first day of school, the last kid on the bus was dropped off at 10 p.m. That caused JCPS to shut down school for about a week to try to figure out something to do, because obviously this plan that they had put in motion was not going to work. And, you know, they have gotten to basically a place that functions. And you know, it's not better, I don't think, than it had been in previous years, but at least it wasn't worse, which was what seemed to happen when they tried to introduce the solution that they did last year. So a few weeks ago, JCPS decided to do something drastic and decided to cut all transportation to magnet schools. We talked about this when it happened. There are a few exceptions, but that was a big drastic step that they caused. They took. This decision that they made will cause a reduction in the number of routes to efficiently transport all the children that you know, are guaranteed transportation to school, but that reduction in the number of routes also represents, you know, a reduction in services. And the most, you know, serious repercussions of those are going to be borne by kids who qualify for magnet schools but cannot get to them due to transportation issues, which is just like the most tragic group of people that you could possibly have this happen to, yeah. Right? It is like, these are the kids that are working hard to get out of the situation that they're in. They're putting in the work, and it's because of our efforts that they cannot, you know, they can't get it. Okay. So that's level setting, right? That's the situation that we found ourselves in before last week. So for a very, very long time, JCPS had two starting times, 7:40 for high school and middle school and 9:30 for elementary school. However, due to this year's routing system, you know, that was eventually, you know, kind of scrapped, the district instituted a system of 9 start times. There were a bunch of different start times. It was very confusing what schools started when and ended when. And, I mean, this was kind of part of that very efficient system that they tried to build that didn't work out. But since the district decided to cut services, all of those start times aren't needed. You don't need all 9 start times. They're going to kind of go back to a smaller set of start times. And last week, the school district voted to move the number of start times back to 3. In essence, that's the story. That's not that big a news if you aren't somebody who is directly impacted. But I think it's important because of the vibe that kind of resulted from this vote and everything that kind of happened out of it.
The vibes are bad.
The vibes got quite, quite bad. Yeah, there was a major reaction. I think it revealed a major lack of trust in JCPS leadership, and it's a real problem. So ahead of the vote, JCPS unveiled like 2 options that they were evaluating for consideration. The school board eventually, you know, voted for option 1 or whatever. They didn't really consider the second option or whatever. But there was this major presence at this meeting from principals to show opposition to an option 3, which was never really presented, in which JCPS said wasn't an official option. There were reasons that all the details about what option 3 was to me are like rumors and innuendos because they didn't actually present it. I have heard that potentially like JCPS floated it to principals, and then when they said, no, we really don't want this, they backed off of it, but they were worried that the leadership was going to try to push it through anyway because some of them supported it. It got really kind of contentious and confusing. They ended up not presenting it. But yeah, it was this weird kind of like just bad vibe in this meeting where they did make a pretty significant decision, but one that probably wasn't super newsworthy.
And Was there like another meeting where principals met to discuss this option 3 or something?
That's something I've heard as well.
This
option got floated to principals. The principals kind of organized themselves. They got JCTA involved. They were like organized this opposition to this option 3, which was never eventually presented. And maybe it wasn't presented because of this unified opposition and all these people that showed up, right? So that could be one of the reasons why it went that way. You know, there wasn't any official documentation of it. I've heard about it, but I don't know what's real and what's not. The thing that we do know is real is that a bunch of principals showed up, expressed opposition to a plan that was never officially presented, and they ended up not going with the plan that they didn't like. They went with a different plan. Yeah, so is that clear or is that confusing? Okay.
I wanted to make sure, like, which meeting I knew that we were talking about, because I heard about, like, a potential principal meeting, and then there's the JCPS board meeting.
It seemed like that meeting did happen. You know, I wasn't there. I can't confirm that it happened.
Journalists reported
happening. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. A bunch of people don't show up for a big school board meeting and express unified opposition to something without meeting ahead of time. So it would stand to reason that they did have some sort of organization that happened. So in the wake of all this decision, JCPS board member Chris Kolb wrote a letter addressed to principals, which was quite scathing. He criticized principals for their opposition to a plan that wasn't discussed at Option 3, and also said, quote, that many of you are simply dismissing the science behind later start times for teens because it is an inconvenient truth, unquote. I think that probably was what Option 3 was about, more shifting high school to later time and elementaries to earlier time, and there was reasons why the principals were opposed to it, but Chris Kolb clearly wants that situation to happen because of the science around, you know, kids' brains. I remember when I was in high school, I definitely wanted a later start time. I think schools don't want a start time that's like after 9 because, I mean, that means you're there for a much later day. You have to get there a lot earlier, etc. So anyways, that was the first quote. It was very, very scathing. Kolb went on to say that principals needed to be able to react to a lot of changes which would be coming. And this is another quote. If you feel that you are not up to the task of leading through what will be a rapidly evolving environment, then please consider that it may be best for you and the children of Jefferson County that you step aside and allow someone to lead who will embrace the opportunities that crisis presents, unquote. That is by far the harshest thing I've ever read from a school board member to employees of the district. I've been in this school district pretty much my whole life. I've been here most of my life. I paid attention to the school board for a long time. This is serious. This is like some really, really harsh rhetoric coming from the school board that is very out of character for the way that this body usually functions. And,
yeah.
And it is, it's troubling. It's troubling. I mean, I don't really know what to take away from that letter. I mean, Jasmine, what did you think when you first saw it, and what's your reaction now?
When I first saw it, I was just like, why? Like, what is the point of this? Like, who is this directed to that, like, that it could possibly help or better the situation at all? It's just a threat. Like, it's a threatening letter. In my opinion,
it feels very threatening. And yet in the letter, I didn't write this down, but like, he's very clear that like the only person who they can hire and fire is the superintendent. And he said, like, it reflects very poorly on Marty Polio. But at the same time, Chris Kolb is one of Marty Polio's like greatest allies.
So. Right. And when I first read it, I was like, oh, this is like critical of Polio, but then I kind of read it again and I was like, no, this is like a threat to like school administration. And he's trying to take up for Polio.
He doesn't have the ability to do anything about principals. Right. So he's like writing this letter. That's like, I know I can't do anything to you guys, but I can only do stuff to him. I'm really frustrated by you guys, but like my only lever of control is this guy that I really like. It just feels like he's like really frustrated with the situation and had something to get off his chest. But, you know, discretion often is the better part of valor. That is not Chris Kolb's best trait, I don't think, throughout the years. But it is certainly, like, it doesn't seem like it solves any problem. It doesn't seem like it drives anything forward. It doesn't seem like it presents any solutions. It's just this weirdly threatening letter to school principals that I don't understand what good could possibly come of this. I mean, I don't think that it's going to cause any principals to back down from their positions.
Right.
And it just kind of like stirs up this negative energy and this negative kind of confluence around JCPS right now to a worse place than it was before.
And I think that I've come to kind of view Chris Kolb very differently in the last few months as a board member. Like, I used to see him as, you know, perhaps the most progressive JCPS board member who sometimes made people mad on Twitter, but mostly like conservative people. And that was fine. Like, I was fine with him messing with people on the internet and everything, and usually agreed with his policies, but it seems like things have really shifted. The way he's handled the board meetings and then this letter, his way of like governing on the board just doesn't seem the same as it did a few years ago.
I fully agree with that. I feel like he's definitely changed quite a bit. I mean, I remember when he ran for Metro Council in my district, and that was like 2016, I think. And he was like outwardly declaring himself like a socialist at that point. And I mean, I guess he still is. He's, you know, in some ways aligned with like the socialist group in town, but like I don't guess he's like a technical member. I don't know. They used to be or are. I don't really know what their current relationship is, but they have often been like fond of Chris Kolb, and he often has like tried to stake out this sort of like very progressive socialist type position on many issues. But in his most recent year, I mean, I would say it's probably been within like 2 years, he went from being like very loud and very outspoken about issues, most of which I agreed with, but I was like, wow, this guy's really stirring the pot here, to being like mostly radio silent, not really saying much at all, and now is doing this thing where he's like threatening principles, which I don't really think has much of an ideological bent, except for that he seems to be supporting Marty Polio, but it's not great. It's not a great situation. I don't know what to make of Chris Kolb. I don't know if he's going to run for re-election. He is up this time. You don't have to file for school board election until after the primary. So I don't know what's going to happen there. There are a few people that have said they are going to leave the school board. And that kind of gets to my last point about this, which is that JCPS is facing a lot of challenges right now, and its leadership, both at inside of the administration building, the employees, and also the board, seems to be fraying in a really bad way. I think a lot of the pressures of that, the reason this situation is so like racked with problems, can be laid at the feet of state government. Examples include their refusal to fund transportation at 100%, their desire, the state government's just like, I guess, desire to go against the wishes of the people who actually live in the district in a lot of ways, breaking it up and also just forcing charters. They passed a bill that said Louisville had to have a charter school a couple years. I mean, there's like all of these things where like people from out in the state and government leaders, state government leaders from out in the state are trying to impose their will on the school children of Jefferson County. And it takes a lot of energy to kind of fight against that, and a lot of just like it's very difficult to do, and it will cause a lot of stress for sure. Mm-hmm. But all of that to be said, leaders have to lead, right? You have to lead, and these are the problems in front of you that you actually have the control over and that you can fix if you have the right, you know, if you put the right things together, if you actually do the leadership. And it feels to me right now that a lot of the people who should be providing that leadership are really kind of falling apart in face of that pressure, or also just kind of like checking out of the problems. It's really troubling. It's not something I feel really great about. I do hope that these elections and the people who come in to replace a couple of the people that are retiring, you know, are able to like provide the leadership that we need, because I just don't think we're getting it right now from anybody. So it's a sad state of affairs. I think it is kind of like playing right into the hands of the Republicans in Frankfurt, who, I mean, I think,
yeah,
it's fair to say,
yeah, absolutely.
I think they want to see JCPS fail. I think that they have tried really hard to put the pieces in position to cause failure. And you know, in a lot of ways, they're getting it. And that's unfortunate. And I don't think it was necessary. I think that there's more leadership that could have been provided. And I certainly hope, you know, that they're able to turn it around, whether it's with the folks that are there now or with new folks in the future. Anything else to say about JCPS this week?
I think you're right what you're saying, that it's playing into the hands of Frankfurt, because it is tough to be on the JCPS school board, because Frankfurt has it out for Louisville and JCPS specifically. And so that's one thing you have to deal with already. And because of some of these conservative wedge issues, there are certain groups of people showing up at meetings and raising these issues over the years, like CRT and all these different things. So it is tough to be on the school board, but to fix some of the problems, we need a solid functioning school board with members who can step up and lead. And
in the face of everything that we're facing from Frankfurt, we need more than a solid functioning framework. We need an excellent school board. You know, we have to have the very best if we're going to succeed, because we are just facing roadblocks that even if we overcome them, we'll just be replaced with other roadblocks. You know, and it's a hard job that nobody really, I mean, it's difficult to do. And yeah, it's just really tough right now. So elections this fall and next Tuesday. Jasmine, speaking of elections next Tuesday, what a transition. Tell us about these congressional elections that are happening coming up next week.
Yeah, we're going to talk some more about elections. This is the congressional edition. So in Kentucky 1, we don't really have a primary to talk about. That is James Comer's seat. Aaron Marshall is running in this race as the Democrat, and I just wanted to mention it because she's already running hard without a primary. She's a 29-year-old single mom from Frankfort, which you might not think is part of District 1, which we think of as a Western Kentucky district, but thanks to redistricting, it is part of District 1. Abortion has already been a big part of her campaign, and she's gotten some earned media around this issue. She's been raising money. So for me, it's exciting to see a candidate running hard in this race.
Yeah. This is a candidate that's being managed. The campaign is being managed by Mark Nicholas, who's a name that if you're into campaigns, you may know. If you're an old-time Kentucky politics head, you may remember Bluegrass Report from like the 2000s, which was his major blog that he ran. That was like the most important thing in Kentucky politics for like a decade. Mark Nicholas also ran Amy McGrath's both congressional and Senate campaigns. And while, I mean, I think the Senate campaign where she ran against, Mitch McConnell, it kind of like, I don't know, it was whatever.
That one was a bit of a flop.
Yeah, understood. And
but that was like, her flop era.
It was her flop, sure, yeah, it was her flop era. But I do think we do need to remember that when she ran for Congress, like, she came within, like, a point of winning in District 6.
Yeah.
And nobody since then, or really before then, has been able to do as good of a job. Now, Mark Nicholas raises a bunch of money. He gets paid a lot of money. But like, that's okay. He runs a pretty good race. It's going to be impossible to win this race, but it'll be really interesting. I think Jamie Comer, we've talked about Jamie Comer a lot this year. I think that there's definitely a race that can be ran against him. He deserves a good opponent, and I think he's going to get one. I got to meet Aaron Marshall this weekend. I was really impressed by her. And yeah, looking forward to this race for sure.
So in Kentucky 2, that's Brett Guthrie's seat. The Democratic primary is William Dakota Compton and Hank Linderman, and they're facing off in the Democratic primary for the second time. These two both ran in the primary for the seat in 2022, and Linderman won with 58% of the vote, but he only got 28% against Brett Guthrie in the general election. Both of these candidates come from music backgrounds, which I find interesting. Hank Linderman is a musician and recording engineer, and Compton has a music degree and is a school orchestra director. So I don't know if these candidates like know each other well or anything, but in my head, I just imagine there's some kind of like musician beef in the area, and so they're running for Congress against each other.
I don't think that's what's happening.
I don't either.
But Hank Linderman's actually played with some like really some really impressive groups. Like he's played with like the Eagles, and he's like a pretty accomplished professional musician. And yeah, I know Hank a little bit. He serves in several Democratic Party offices, and he's really committed to this seat. I mean, I really am encouraged, and you know, I really love to see him you know, not allowing the seat to go unchallenged. But William Dakota Compton, who I don't know as well, I think I've only met him like once or twice very briefly, also is committed like this. And it's really great, I think, to have these two going up every time to see who's going to face Brett Guthrie. You know, obviously it's an uphill climb to win in District 2. That's like traditionally thought of as like the Owensboro. Wait, is that right? How are they doing that now? I think
it's the Bowling Green seat. That's Bowling Green. It has like Bowling Green, Hart County.
Does it have Owensboro? It has both. Okay, so now they got both. Now it's got Owensboro. And, yeah. That's right, because they had to ditch one of them to get Frankfort into the other. So, okay. All right. So it has both Owensboro and Bowling Green now, which, you know, could play in the Democrats' hands a little better. Obviously, those aren't Democratic counties, but they are a little bit more urban. And, like, as time goes on, as we build towards, you know, successful campaigns in these kind of districts, having those more urban areas could be helpful. But, yeah, these two are to be commended for the race that they're running. Best of luck to them. But yeah, it's going to be an uphill climb to beat Bert.
Yeah. Hank Linderman has been the Democratic nominee for this district since 2018. So it's good that we always have someone challenging the seat. The problem is that, you know, the party doesn't put money into this race because it's been a Republican stronghold. And so neither of them have been able to raise very much money. Linderman's raised about $7,000 and Compton has about $4,500 to Brett Guthrie's $1.8 million that he has.
It's a hard question. It's a difficult debate, right? Because it's like money is a finite resource, especially in Democratic politics in Kentucky, you know, and would you rather have the party spend $1 million to try to establish some sort of organizing campaign to make District 2 more competitive, or would you rather have them spend it on state house and senate races in the suburbs in Louisville and Lexington because those seats seem a little bit more winnable? And you know, those are hard questions, and I honestly, like, I think that there's a debate to be had there about what the best thing to do there is, but it will be interesting to see how things kind of happen in District 1 versus 2, because I do think Erin Marshall is going to be able to raise a lot of money, and whether or not the party comes in and backs her because she's able to raise that money will be really interesting versus District 2, where obviously these two are going to have are having a bigger struggle to raise money. I don't think there will be as much going there. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out. But yeah, that's District 2.
Kentucky 3 is Morgan McGarvey's seat. He does have two primary opponents, Jared Randall, who I can't really find much evidence of running very hard, and then Jeff Young, who is a perennial candidate, who actually ended up becoming the Democratic nominee in Kentucky 6 in the last cycle. But I don't see that happening again here. Morgan McGarvey will easily win his primary. And there is a Republican who has filed. I don't think that they've started running very hard at this point either. So that's Kentucky 3.
Yeah, Jeff Young, I think, is running in this district because you do not technically have to live in the district in order to run. I think he still lives in Lexington and is running in Louisville. So
yeah, so he's trying a new tactic. Okay. So yeah, Kentucky 4 is Thomas Massey, and Democrats didn't even put up a candidate in this district this time. There, you know, a few years ago we had two women on who ran in a primary for this seat, and then Matt Lehman ran in the last cycle, and ran a strong campaign. But this time Democrats have no one.
All right, Jasmine, I'm gonna ask you this. If you could have, this is about Matt Lehman, but just like take Matt Lehman, the person, out of it. If you could have somebody running harder in that seat for Rachel Works's state house seat, or somebody running against Thomas Massey, which would you prefer to have?
The Rachel Rourke.
Yeah, no, not Robert. Rachel Rourke. Rachel
Roberts.
Different person. I think that that's kind of the thing, right? I mean, it's unfortunate, but the way that these districts are drawn, I mean, Northern Kentucky, even though it's getting more Democratic, it just really can't overcome those river counties and those, you know, the set, whatever it is, like the area between Shelby County and Northern Kentucky, that's just extremely liberty focused, Boone County, like mm-hmm. it's just really hard to overcome Thomas Massie's advantage there. And while I do wish we had somebody to put up there, and it's really disappointing for Democrats in that district not to have somebody to vote for instead of Thomas Massie. It's hard there.
Yeah, it's definitely tough. Thomas Massie does have a primary against Eric Dieters, who ran for governor, and someone named Michael McGinnis. I don't see Massie having Eric Dieters does have his fans, but I don't see Massie having trouble with his primary.
No, definitely not. I'm really interested to see how much Eric Dieters pulls. I mean, he kind of did stake out like a unique position in the gubernatorial campaign. There was nobody really in that lane when Savannah Maddox dropped out, but like he kind of is the same. He's like a more quixotic version of Thomas Massie, if that's even possible, right? I
mean, right.
Like, what a choice. Yeah, so I don't think that they're separate enough to like for Eric Dieters to really face up against him. So we'll see.
Yeah. Kentucky 5 is Hal Rogers. That's the Eastern Kentucky seat. And Hal Rogers drew several primary opponents, but one of them, Dana Edwards, is actually raising money. He's raised over $300,000. Dr. Dana Edwards has worked as a surgeon for the VA, and he's also treated patients dealing with drug addiction. And from what I can gather, it seems that Edwards is running to the right of Hal Rogers because he says that he'd be the only Kentuckian who would be part of the Freedom Caucus if elected.
You know, sometimes I wonder about like the way that we traditionally think of like right and left and like whether those things are super meaningful all the time. I mean, you've mentioned this to me before. There's like members of the Kentucky legislature who are like really good on labor issues but have like all this Trump stuff all over their car and like really love, you know, all this weird right wing stuff. And like I don't mm-hmm. know, like I feel like Eastern Kentucky, Appalachia part of Kentucky, like they're gonna have unique political views. And I think that, you know, Hal Rogers, I don't know if he's, I mean, he's been there forever. He's been there. You want to talk about how long Gerald Neal's been there? Hal Rogers makes Gerald Neal yeah. a baby, right? So it's like, you know, he has been there.
Yeah, Congress is worse than the General Assembly when it comes to terms yeah. So, and people being there a long time.
So I don't really know what to think about this opposition that he's drawn. Clearly, this person's running against him. We'll see what happens. And I'm like really interested to see what happens in that district after Hal Rogers decides to leave. Like, who's going to take over? That's going to be a really crazy situation because there's a lot of people who wanted to go to Congress from the 5th district. But yeah, you know, probably will be Hal Rogers again this time. He's like 85 or something, isn't he? He's like very old. I don't know, but you know, you do you, Hal Rogers.
Then the last one is Kentucky 6, so that is Andy Barr's seat. And the 6th district has a 5-way Democratic primary. So Todd Kelly, Randy Cravens, Don Pratt, Jonathan Richardson, and Shauna Rudd have all filed for the seat.
Wow.
Todd Kelly has reported raising approximately $45,000, and Cravens only has $2,300. Todd Kelly is a nurseryman, and he's also a Quaker, I learned. Randy Cravens ran a write-in campaign in the last cycle after Jeff Young became the Democratic nominee after beating Chris Priest in the primary. Cravens got about 9,000 votes, which was about 3.6% as a write-in candidate. Cravens is the only candidate in Richmond. All the other candidates are in Lexington, and he works in IT management. I couldn't find a lot of information about Don Pratt. I see that he ran for city council in Lexington in 2014. And then Jonathan Richardson is a young Black candidate who has started a nonprofit in Lexington. And Shauna Rudd is a licensed clinical social worker, so a therapist. She's from Breathitt County, who stayed in Lexington after she came to UK for college. And Randy Cravens received the Herald Leader endorsement in this race. So it seems like Todd Kelly really has the money in the race, but Cravens got the Herald Leader endorsement, which could be helpful, you know, for people who may not know which way to go.
Yeah.
There.
I think that will be a lot of people. I mean, the 6th District is, I mean, I think they did kind of shore it up a little bit for Andy Barr in redistricting, but, like, it was clearly a district that he's, you know, really, really taken to the next level for Republicans. And, I mean, he does very good with constituent services. I mean,
he really does. I mean, it used to be a Democratic district held by Ben Chandler. Andy Barr came close to beating him and then did beat him. And ever since then, it's been really hard to get it back.
Except for that one time that Amy McGrath ran.
Amy McGrath
and
almost did.
Yeah, and it is kind of like, it's tough, right? It's a tough district because, like, I do think Andy Barr is, like, especially focused on, you know, on, like, he does a good job of getting Lexington people to vote for him. You know, it's likely to be his seat as long as he wants it to. And I think the quality of opposition that Democrats have been putting up since the redistricting is evidenced here. But, you know, it, with the money, especially looking like, you know, there's more people who've raised money to run in 5 as a Republican against Hal Rogers. There's more money being raised in District 1 to run against Jamie Comer. And you know, District 6, the most money that anybody has is $45,000. Like, that's just evidence that it's just not as strong a race as it could be. Now, it could turn around after the primary, like, you know, Lexington does not. I mean, Lexington Democrats don't like Andy Barr being their, you know, congressional representative. But it's hard to win against him. It has been hard to win against him for a very long time. And there you go. I don't know. That seems to be the situation there.
I think Amy McGrath taught us that it can be done just with how close she came, but it feels like after that people were like, well, she didn't do it, so
yeah,
it's over.
It's not over. It's never over. We do this every 2 years, so it's it's over till it's not. And Amy McGrath did show us. I mean, you mentioned Ben Chandler and it being a Democratic district. You know, it was a Republican before that too. Like, Ernie Fletcher was the 6th district representative and ran for governor and won. And that's how Ben Chandler ended up there, was because he ran in the special election after Ernie Fletcher became the governor. That's how he became a congressman. So you know, he did serve for 3 terms, but the demographics of you know, Ben Chandler's coalition that got him into Congress is not there anymore. What Amy McGrath showed us was what a modern coalition looks like and how close it could come. It can still do that. You just have to have somebody who's willing to raise multiple millions of dollars. And
yeah,
you know, I remember during that race, all my friends in Lexington were like, oh my gosh, if anybody else knocks on my door, we got to have that again. We got to have people so sick and tired of being contacted that they get mad. that's what it takes to win. And I just, it's going to be tough to do that again after a disappointment there many times over. So, I mean, I don't see much change in Kentucky's congressional delegation after the 2024 elections, but it's always good to check in on what's going on. So thanks, Jasmine, for bringing us that information. We will
We should at least know who's running.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, and I didn't know some of these candidates, so I learned new things.
Yeah, it was the Democratic Party's dinner last Friday, and Morgan McGarvey gave one of the speeches, and he talked about how some of the folks in the Congress make Damon Thayer look like a teddy bear, which I thought was pretty funny. He mentioned, like, Marjorie Taylor Greene. But yeah, this is a very large, important lawmaking body for the entire country, so who we send there really does matter. So even if they're not going to probably be super competitive in Kentucky this year, so... when you go to vote next week, that is who you'll have, or potentially at the end of this week, right? Because early voting starts, I think, Friday. I think so. We should probably get that right.
Yeah, let's
Kentucky
let's,
early.
Let's redo that.
No, we're just gonna leave it in.
No.
Kentucky early voting 2024. Early voting happens on the 16th, 17th, and 18th. So that is Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. So that is when early voting is this year. And then, of course, the regular election, the primary election, will be held on the 21st, which is next Tuesday. So go vote. And we'll be here to talk about what happens next. I haven't talked to you about this, Jasmine, but we should do next week's show on Wednesday so we can talk about election results. What do you think?
Yeah, sure.
All right. All right. Well, there you go. Let's get to our interview with Attica Scott.
Attica Scott is a candidate for Kentucky State Senate in District 33. Previously, she served three terms as a Kentucky State Representative and has served on the Louisville Metro Council. And she also ran for U.S. Congress in District 3 in 2022. So, Attica Scott, welcome back to my old Kentucky podcast.
Thank you so much, Jasmine. I appreciate you.
Yeah, we definitely appreciate you as well. Yeah, so, I mean, just to get started, you know, the last time I think we talked to you was when you were running for U.S. Congress in 2022. And, you know, you lost that election, found yourself out of elected office for the first time since, I think, like 2017 is when you first went in this state house. You'd been in elected office before that, too. So, you found yourself out of office for the first time in a while. So, how long after that happened did you realize that you wanted to run for something again? And how did you land on running for Kentucky State Senate?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I was in the state house for 6 years, so not too terribly long, long enough, but it was actually good to step away and get a fresh perspective. In some respects, I was forced to leave, so I was going to be out of there regardless. To be honest with you, they cut my district in half with redistricting, but you know, we didn't talk about that too much. It just kind of happened and, you know, my party let it go. So there was that. And it took a good year plus, because it wasn't until the end of 2023 when I started talking to people who live in Senate District 33, particularly people like Ms. Jackie Floyd, who literally had been saying for years that we need some new and different leadership, representing her in particular as a sassy, sexy singer, she calls herself. and she kept encouraging me. And I finally said, okay, all right, I'm going to do it. And that's why she and Councilwoman Parrish Wright joined me when I signed my filing papers, and then joined me when I went to Frankfort to file the papers to run for state senate.
Yeah, so we want to talk a little bit about your time in Frankfort, and you know, maybe your time potentially in the future there. Your time in Frankfort as a member of the House was full of both professional and personal indignities, and I don't think anyone would fault you if you decided to wash your hands of the Capitol. But you are running really hard against a longtime incumbent, and you're trying to get back to work. So, you know, why do you want to go back?
Yeah, I appreciate that question as well. I had the opportunity this weekend to spend a little bit of time with former State Representative Mary Lou Marzian, and we had this very question at Big Bar on Bardstown Road, this very conversation. And we feel similarly that it's important. We've seen what's been happening over the past 2 years that we've not been in office. And we know it's important to have women's voices standing up on so many of the issues that are impacting Louisville and our entire Commonwealth. And I know for myself, I've been quite disappointed in the failure of Senator Neal on speaking up about some of the biggest issues that are happening in our Commonwealth and to the city of Louisville. And I can't just sit back. Like, that's just not in my nature, right? I tell people all the time, listen, I grew up in the projects of Beecher Terrace. Those people in Frankfort don't scare me at all because they're big bullies. They're not going to come up to anybody's face and say any of the mess that they say in Frankfort. They're going to say it on the House and the Senate floor because they're also very weak, but they are not going to come to our neighborhoods and say the same things to us. If when they do, the very few times they do come to our neighborhoods, it's often just to shake hands and kiss babies and take pictures.
Yeah. When you've been in Frankfort, I don't think it's any secret that Republican leadership has refused to move any Democratic bill, but it kind of seemed like they may be especially delighted in frustrating you. What would mark a successful term in Frankfort for you in the Senate? You know, do you think you would be able to move any legislation while serving there?
Listen, I was married to a Republican from West Virginia for more than a decade. We have two amazing kids together, and I know how to frustrate Republican right back. And that's exactly what I did when I was in Frankfort. And I will say, right, that like you said, there were so many Democratic bills that did not get passed, although some did, but not by the Black legislators for about 5 years until Representative Reginald Meeks and I for a whole session raised a fuss about it, and people kept trying to ignore us. And I was like, you're not going to keep ignoring us on this issue. I know Kentucky doesn't like to talk about race. Louisville doesn't either, but we're going to talk about it because that's exactly what happened for 5 years. We didn't have any Black people's bills that were even heard, let alone passed. But our white Democratic colleagues, every session did have at least a couple of bills that passed. So that's important for me to acknowledge because that's a reality that we don't talk about and that we have to. And I'm going to talk about it. And I will say that I'm going to keep doing the work. I didn't hesitate when I was in Frankfurt to file big, big, big important bills that were brought to me by the people that I was representing. And even folks who didn't live in the district, like students from Lexington and here in Louisville came together and said, would you please file a bill to allow student journalists to have freedom of the press because they were barred from covering Donald Trump when he was in Lexington several years ago. Yes, of course, right? I'm going to listen to anybody from across Kentucky. And whether or not the state legislature is going to pass the bill doesn't mean I'm not going to file it and be a champion of it. And that's the difference, too, that sometimes people file bills, but they're not champions of their own bills. They just let them sit and they give up, right? And they concede to the MAGA extremists in Frankfurt. I never did that. I kept championing every single bill that I filed and made sure that people across Kentucky knew about it. And Jasmine, to your question, I will say that even if they, even when they didn't pass the bills in Frankfurt, they did hear the bill to ban no-knock warrants. We knew they weren't going to pass it, but it also was part of a policy movement across Kentucky, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Has no-knock warrants, has a no-knock warrant ban. Louisville has a no-knock warrant ban. The same with the Crown Act. Robert Stivers, the president of the Senate, said to my face, I would never hear a bill about hair. Oh, that's some real privilege right there. But OK, so Louisville, Frankfurt, Covington Lexington have all filed the Crown, passed the Crown Act. So I believe in helping to build policy movements.
I do have a quick follow up question. Do you think that there has been, do you see the Senate as maybe like working together a little bit better than the House has with a smaller caucus? Or do you think that the personalities in the Senate, do you think that they work together any better than the members of the House?
That's a good question. Unfortunately for me, especially living in the West End of Louisville and seeing the West End TIF pass, which is now, you know, there's a lawsuit filed against the TIF. When I see people in the Senate working together, it's sometimes to hurt where I live. Mm-hmm. So I'm not really impressed by that, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I think I'd be more impressed if you were doing something that actually answer people's calls for justice in 2020 rather than claiming that a tax increment financing district was an answer to our cries.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate your perspective on how your efforts kind of help in other places. I mean, you were the first person that I ever heard talk about the Crown Act, and you mentioned all the places that had passed in Kentucky, but it's also passed a lot of other states across the country that are, you know, have more progressive or democratic legislatures. And I mean, I think that that's a credit to you. I think that those places it's unlikely. I think that those places would have had those bills as quickly if you hadn't done the work that you did here in Kentucky. And also, as somebody who was married to somebody married in West Virginia, you got to watch out when you make those people mad. I know about that also. So,
yeah.
you mentioned a few of these things already, but you have been the champion of many issues in Frankfurt and oftentimes the only person speaking up on many issues in Frankfurt. I wrote a few down, you know, and just generically, like abortion rights and civil rights, but I did write down the Crown Act, which is something you mentioned already. What are the issues that if you make it back, you will be the champion of, that you expect to be the person speaking out on when a lot of people won't?
Yeah, no, I appreciate that question, Robert. And I will say, knocking on doors and talking to people, and in particular from between 2022 and 2024, one thing that I have found that some people, when I was in the state legislature, would say, oh, you know, Black folks, because they're church going, they don't believe in abortion rights. I was like, because y'all don't talk to us. So I was knocking on doors in 2022 and now in 2024. And that's what so many Black women older, I'm talking old enough to be my parents, right? 70, 80 years old, who are talking about access to abortion. They're like, I can't have any babies anymore and I don't want to. But I also want to make sure that if my grandchild doesn't want to have a baby, that they don't have to be forced to. So I'm going to keep standing up for abortion access and abortion rights because I know that's what my neighbors want me to stand up for. I'm going to keep fighting for access to the full spectrum of healthcare, right? Like, we got to talk about Black maternal health. Not one person was talking about that until I got to Frankfurt. Black maternal health specifically, not just in general, generically, but specifically. I also know that we've got to do a lot of work around housing issues in Kentucky. And I'm not just talking about affordable housing. I'm talking about things like rent stabilization. People can't afford to pay the rent. And I'm tired of seeing all the folks' belongings on the curb in my neighborhood and in the West End of Louisville. We got to do something about the fact that rent is too high for everybody. And I'm going to keep, you know, fighting for those issues. Those are some of the issues that I'm hearing people talk about and lift up. And of course, folks are talking about gun safety with a legislature that keeps making access to guns easier, right? And the ability to carry guns easier. So those are just some of the issues that I'm going to continue to fight for.
I think it's safe to say that when future students of Kentucky history study the era that we're in now, I think you'll be a person that's part of that story. So do you think much about your own legacy? And, you know, how do you hope the future remembers your service to the Commonwealth?
I don't, Jasmine, because I'm not going to be in those books. I mean, you know, I'm honest with myself.
We hope that you are.
Listen, I know that I'm not the kind of person that my own political party would put into a book. So that's fine, because that's not why I'm doing it, right? I'm doing it for people who have felt voiceless and left out and left behind. And that's perfectly fine for me. If no one ever speaks my name again, that's fine. That's not why I'm doing it, right? So I don't expect to be in anybody's history book.
You definitely will be. I understand where you're coming from, and especially being the person who's doing all this work and facing all of this, all the things that you face on, you know, every year that you step up to do this, it can be hard to realize it. But you will be there for sure. So that's fine, and you know, that will probably be how you'll remembered, as somebody who stood up to fight when a lot of people wouldn't. So you are, of course, we mentioned this a little bit before, you are running in a contested primary against a long-term incumbent. Just very briefly, what makes you the best choice in the election next week?
Yeah, Robert. Important question for primary election day on May 21st. I'll start by saying there were three people in this race. Michael Churchill got into it in 2023. I didn't get in until 2024. And I just really want to acknowledge the fact that he often got forgotten about. And so I tried to maintain a relationship and connection with him and check in with him periodically just to see how things were going. And every time somebody called me to either do an interview or be part of a forum, I would always say, you do know there are three people in this race and I'm the only woman. And so when Michael decided to suspend his race, he endorsed our campaign, which was a huge honor. I really, really was honored by the fact that he did that. And now it's me and a 35-year incumbent, Senator Gerald Neal. 35 years is a freaking long time to be in office. And I believe that we should share leadership. Like, no one person should be in office that long, because there's so many people who deserve to have the opportunity to serve. And that just keeps people out. So I'm feeling really good about the campaign, out doing the work every single day, knocking on doors, rain or shine, it doesn't matter. Out knocking on doors, making phone calls, trying to raise money. All of it. And I know that I am the best person for the job, because I'm going to be a champion of District 33 from Clifton all the way down Cane Run Road to the Bullitt County line. And people know that. If they are honest with themselves, they know that, because I always have been a champion for folks, regardless of who they are or where they live, what they value, or what they believe in. I've stood up for and with people. So I'm going to continue to do that work.
Before we let you go, if people are interested in helping you out in this last week here before the primary, how can they get involved in your campaign?
Yeah, wonderful question, Jasmine. So please visit atticaforkentucky.com, A-T-T-I-C-A-F-O-R, Kentucky spelled out, .com. And you can sign up to knock on doors with me. You can sign up to make phone calls. It's a little bit late in the race to host a house party, but of course you can donate right to the campaign. So we are constantly out there every single day, and we've got opportunities for folks in whatever way they want to show up. Some people, you know, have a lot of anxiety around knocking on a door and talking to somebody they've never met before. Mm-hmm. That's fair. You can make a phone call, or you can drop some lit.
I always think it's easier to knock on their door than make the phone call. They're meaner usually on the phone. They're nice at the door.
It's true.
All right. Well, Attica Scott, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you being here with us today.
Thanks, y'all. Bye.
Jasmine, how can people get a hold of us?
They can like us on Twitter and Instagram at my old KY pod. They can like our Facebook page and listen to our podcast on the podcast app of their choice. We also have a newsletter you can subscribe to at tinyletter.com/myoldkentuckynewsletter. And you can support what we're doing on Patreon for as little as a dollar a month. You can do that at patreon.com/myoldkentuckypodcast. And last but not least, we're part of the Dimcast Network and the Forward Kentucky Network.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. And we will see you next week.